Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
WNYC Soundcheck.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The singer Adele recently revealed that she suffers from stage fright. And that makes her the latest in a long list of musical superstars who have to deal with what can be an almost crippling problem. But you don't have to be Adele or Barbara Streisand or Luciano Pavarotti to know just how miserable stage fright can be. I remember the first time I was invited to lecture at a college. It was Bucknell University. I showed up on campus and was completely blindsided by a sudden attack of stage fright. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't eat. I could hardly breathe. The chairman of the music department had taken me for a nice breakfast before the class, and what little food I could choke down soon... Well, you don't need the gory details. The point is, I was a mess. Then the lecture went pretty well. So what was that all about? The reason I've been thinking about this is there's a new book out called Top Dog: The Science of Winning and Losing. In it, the authors look at how practice doesn't always make perfect when it comes time to perform, in our jobs, in sports, in the performing arts. Why do some people wilt under pressure and others seem to thrive on it? It's a kind of news you can use thing, and we'll find out more in just a bit. Plus, an explanation from Billboard magazine about the new way they're compiling their closely watched chart of hit singles. But first...
And I loved, like I always do. And I cried, like I cried for you. And Balloon Man blew up in my hand.
Robin Hitchcock founded the art rock band The Soft Boys in the 70s. Led this cult favorite, the Egyptians, in the 80s, and then moved on to a solo career as singer, songwriter, actor, and just general all-around alternative rock godfather.
Attention, rocket ship, projected on a wave. I wish I was the future. I kiss you in the past. I'm coming for you someday.
Robin Hitchcock recorded that album with his occasional band, The Venus Three, back in 2006. Now he's gearing up to celebrate a pretty significant birthday and the upcoming release of a brand new solo album. And that's how we'll hear him today. Robin Hitchcock, solo, in the Soundcheck studio with a new song called My Rain.
My rain, it falls on dark and mossy walls. Do you know where it's been? My rain, dark and purple plums. Do you know what I mean? When the sun is tired of you, hear the rain and all it can do. My rain is light, caresses you all night. Do you know where it's been? This house of ours, it flickers through the hours in the fountains of green. When the moon is under a cloud and the earth is under a shroud,
that is Robin Hitchcock live in the Soundcheck studio with a song called My Rain. That's a somewhat ambiguous ending there.
You mean that chord?
That chord at the end. It doesn't really resolve. It just kind of leaves you. Well,
I suppose that's the situation with the rain, isn't it? It doesn't really go away.
No. Now, that's going to be on Love from London.
That's right, yeah.
The new record. And that is your voice down towards the... That's about as low as it gets, isn't it?
It is, and because I've just been flying and it's down in Mexico with Peter Buck and his collective Hoot.
Mm-hmm. Peter Buck, the former guitarist
from
REM.
And the current guitarist with me and Scott McCoy. Mm-hmm. And but my voice is low, so I started with that one, which is the lowest one on the album. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, as you approach your 60th birthday and you've been using the voice for many years, I mean, have you learned kind of the tricks of dealing with the instrument? You know, it likes it when you start low and work your way
up.
That's
I mean basically, if you've had a big night the night before, your voice is low, and you say you don't go in with the John Lennon impersonations at breakfast. Better to aim for Leonard Cohen or something like that.
Right, right.
And, you know, by the evening, with a bit of luck, you could be up there with Carl Wilson or Green Gartside or somebody. You know.
Nice. Do you get still hit those Carl Wilson, Aaron Neville, those high?
I don't think I ever really hit them the way they did. But the voice is a very dynamic thing, and a lot depends on what you can hear back. That's why I'm wearing the cans, so I can hear the reverb.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it just makes you more confident. Oh, that's all I've learned, really. And start low and get high, basically.
In a manner of speaking.
Quite.
Robin Hitchcock is my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. So Love from London comes out on March 5th, and this is album number 327 or something like that.
I mean, Pretty much.
What about, you mentioned Peter Buck and Scott McCoy. Are these guys on this new record? Or
No, there's no... None of my American friends on it. It's all very British done. Mm-hmm. There's not even any real drums. The whole thing was recorded in a bedroom in East London with the curtains drawn, pretty much about the size of that two of those grand pianos over there. It's a small room full of books and recording gear. As we were saying, you know, the studio, it doesn't really matter what the studio is, as long as you can physically get in there.
Right.
And sing and play, it matters not. You don't need to have, you know, Abbey Road is based on the fact that there are these lovely huge rooms that have a great natural drum sound.
Mm-hmm.
But this has all been sampled. You know, these Abbey Road will soon crumble beneath the waves, but all the sounds that it produced will be flown to Mars or something, and something will be set up there. Knowledge and knowledge is compressed and sent mm-hmm. elsewhere.
Well, now, the image of the famed Abbey Road Studios sinking beneath the waves, that kind of gets into, the sort of environmental concerns that have been creeping into some of what you've been doing. I mean, in 2008, you went on one of those,
Cape Farewell. Trip up to, Greenland.
To Greenland. Ryuichi Sakamoto went on one of those.
We were on the same one. Ryuichi and Noriko, yes, that's right.
Explain what Camp Farewell is.
Cape Farewell is an organization, a charity organization that raises money to promote environmental awareness. And it's a cliche, but it's probably the best way of describing it. By inviting artists and scientists in various combinations to go to imperiled areas, mm-hmm. particularly the Arctic, but they have done one down in the Amazon. So you go up and you basically see these huge translucent, luminescent glaciers kind of breaking off into the thick green sea. I mean, it's a very beautiful experience, but it's only because these things that have been quite literally solid as rocks or solid as ice for thousands of years are now breaking off as if someone has just turned off the deep freeze. That's it, honey. Sorry, the power's not working anymore. And you know what happens when the deep freeze goes off? The place floods. And basically, we are all seeing this. And, we wrote various songs as a result of it. Martha Wainwright was up there. Kate Tunstall was in the cabin next to me. So she and I recorded a song called There Goes the Ice, which is not on this album, but it is on my website as a Phantom 45. You can listen to it, or if you want a high-res version, you can put 99 cents in the honesty box and download a better quality.
There goes the
how much, how effective artists being made aware of this is a moot point. We don't know. You can't translate it straight away into kind of, wow, Feist says we should stop having pollution. Okay, everybody, out. down come the planes. it's not, gosh, Robin Hitchcock's noticed that the ice cap's melting. Well done. Good on you, Robin, But I suppose it has to start somewhere. London's going to flood. All these coastal regions are going to be underwater. We've prepared ourselves with the disaster movies. Now you've started getting the storms here. Britain has changed. I'm not a politician or an environmentalist. It's just that this is happening and it's going to bleed through all these channels. So even a self-involved artist like myself is going to... It's coming out of the Robin Hitchcock channel, folks. I'm sorry, we can't stop it,
Well, the song "There Goes the Ice," there's a link to it on our website, so you can see the video of Robin Hitchcock and Katie Tunstall. "Love from London," the next Robin Hitchcock record due out in this country on March 5th. You want to do a couple of songs from it for us here?
Okay, this is the second track. It's called "Be Still," and I wrote it on a beach in Tel Aviv. Here we go.
I wonder what she's thinking as she's sitting next to me. although her eyes are open and she's staring at the sea. She's lost in contemplation as her hangs to the ground. I wonder, is she praying? Is she making any sound? Be still. What is swimming through her mind as she sits alone? As beautiful as silence and as quiet as a stone. I wonder where she's heading when she goes back into town. Who does she relate to when she puts her money down? Be still. Let the darkness fall upon you. Be still. Be still. Let the darkness fall upon you. Be still. Be still. Let the darkness fall upon you. Dark as berries and her skin is charcoal brown. She gazes to the future out to where the sun goes down, to where the night is falling on a lover or a friend. Somebody's beginning is just someone else's end. Be still. Let the darkness fall upon you. Be still. Be still. Let the darkness fall upon you. Be still. Be still. Let the darkness fall upon you.
Robin Hitchcock live on Soundcheck with Be Still, a track from his next record, Love from London. How about another track from the new record? You want to do I Love You?
This is the I Love You song. Hang on a second.
Does this require retuning?
No, it requires... That's not bad, is it? Okay. Here we go. I'm here at WNYC. I'm me, I'm Robin Hitchcock. And guess what? I love you, I love you, I love you. I love you, I love you, I love you. I love you, I love you, I love you. I love you. Tendrils grow between us, tendrils you can't see. I'm to
dissolving into you. You're flowing into me. The best of everything, that's what you wanna be. I love you. Real love is generous, there's nothing it withholds. It won't desert you 'cause you're feeling nervous or you're old. Every second that you get to spend together is pure gold. I love you. Nothing in the world's like you, believe me 'cause I've looked. Even if I'm wriggling, you know that I'm still hooked. I stand beside you, honey, naked and uncooked. I love you. I love you. I love you.
Robin Hitchcock, live on Soundcheck. I Love You is the song. It'll be on the next album called Love from London, out on March 5th. Robin Hitchcock with us here in the Soundcheck studio. 60th birthday coming up. You're going to celebrate with a big concert? You're going to do like a retrospective, something from each of the albums?
Their plan is in London to do that at the end of February. My actual birthday is on March the 3rd. Mm-hmm. But the... Yeah, so we're going. I'm going to try and do one song off every release, you know, not including live albums and compilations and stuff that was maybe only available by post or something.
And how many hours will this take?
It's going to take too long, is the answer. So we're making it a cheap ticket. You know, you're looking at like 12 songs a set, and you probably have to do... It's going to be about 25. I mean, it's not pretty, but... but, it, you know, I've never done it before. It will be a chance for me and whoever comes along to kind of go in an accelerated way through 35 years of records.
Mm-hmm. A time-lapse photography.
It's going to be a time... Exactly, exactly, John. It's time. Thank you. It's time-lapse. It's what's that going to be like? We'll see, really.
Will there be room for some covers? There usually are.
No, I'm not doing any covers. I'm concentrating on me for once. My sets and this internet are littered with covers, and I will eventually record a proper covers collection. But I'm actually going to really cover myself and just look at it from an objective point of view. I think this is the song I like from this particular mm-hmm. collection, and I'll do it. But I will have to some extent the outsider's perspective on it. Yeah.
Robin Hitchcock interprets Robin Hitchcock, that sort of thing.
Pretty much, yeah. If it's possible, yeah.
All right. That's happening in London. Robin Hitchcock here with us in our New York studio. It's always great to have you with us. Thanks so much for playing for us today.
It's a pleasure, John. Thank you.
And happy birthday.
Thank you.
This is Soundcheck. If you like Robin Hitchcock and you use the internet, watch a video of Robin performing in the Soundcheck studio. And reduce your office productivity with hundreds of other videos from our archive. Find Robin Hitchcock and much more on soundcheck.org. This Thursday, our regular contributor Joe Levy joins us for a special Soundcheck music quiz. Now, if you think you have what it takes to be a quiz contestant, we want to hear from you. Leave a voice message at 866-939-1612 or send us an email, soundcheck@wnyc.org. You could end up on the air as one of our lucky contestants. Again, tell us about yourself in a voice message, 866-939-1612, or email soundcheck@wnyc.org. The authors of a new book called Top Dog talk about the role that competition plays in the world of music, and later the Hot 100 Singles Chart has long been pop music's competitive battleground, but now the rules are changing. We'll hear about a new formula used to determine the country's most popular songs. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. There's an old saying, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. But authors Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman might have a different answer to that question. Maybe something more along the lines of perform. Perform, perform. They are the authors of the new book, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, and they are here with me in the studio now. Poe, Ashley, thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Ashley, let me start with, you know, this idea that practice doesn't necessarily make perfect. What's at play there?
Well, I think that we're not saying practice is unimportant. Obviously,
right.
Practice is important. But there's been an idea that's becoming really popular that all you need is, you know, 10 years of deliberate practice.
Your 10,000 hours.
Exactly. And what we're saying is, for one, you know, you can be the best in the practice room, but no one cares. It's how you do on stage, ultimately, that's going to matter,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's when you're actually performing. And you actually need to practice performing, right? No amount of practice is going to prepare you for the first time you walk out on stage and see all those people looking at you and waiting for you. And we also know that nobody gets 10 years of practice before you say, okay, it's go time.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't say, oh, I don't have enough hours to practice. They say, no, the recital's tomorrow. Do you know the piece or not?
Now, in the music world, especially in the classical music world, Poe, there's been a kind of a backlash against the competition circuit. You know, pianists, violinists, at an early age, maybe as teenagers, they're sent out to, you know, as enough with the practicing. Let's get you used to performing. And people think, well, you know, is music really a competition? There's been a bit of pushback.
Right.
But it sounds like, from what you guys write in the book, that there is a reason for these kind of competitions.
Really broadly, we understand, if you go to just evolution, we understand ever since Darwin that competitive pressure led to the great diversity of finches. You know, all the different styles of finch was a result of having to compete and find little niches, right? And in the same way, in the great music, you know, spectrum, the competition for audiences, the competition to be better than somebody else has led not to uniformity, but a great diversity of styles of music. And this reproduces itself within the arts and especially within music directly.
I think that, you know, we have this idea that we write about in the book that, you know, great artists don't compete, mm-hmm. right? And so musicians shouldn't compete. We all know that musicians, I think, are pretty competitive. Yeah. Artists can be really competitive.
Poe, it's interesting what Ashley was just talking about. It kind of reminds me, Baroque Europe and the sort of courts of India, where they would sort of compete with each other to have the best court composers and court bands and stuff.
And back then, they didn't have this notion of the idealized artist who is above competition, who is removed from base human motivations of money and power and being better than others. And that whole idea that we wrap art in didn't exist back then. Mm. In fact, if you look at it even on the visual art side, the very notion of that we cared about who painted a painting was something that came out of the Renaissance and directly came out of direct competitions between pieces of art. Prior to that time, we only cared about what was in the painting. What was it a painting of? And when they started putting these together in what were called the paragone, or now what we'd say a paragon, which was a direct head-to-head competition in Italy in a single room where people could judge which painting was better, once it was like, wow, we want to know who painted that, and we elevated this notion of the artist through competition.
Well, the competition got pretty stiff in Central Europe, you know, in what is now Germany, but which in Bach's day was, as you guys point out in the book, lots of little fiefdoms and principalities. And someone like Bach, as you might imagine, very much in demand. And Ashley, you point out that one of Bach's greatest pieces was probably begun while he was in prison.
Right.
Because he wanted to get away from his old job and go to a new one.
Right. He wanted to be the head of Prince Leopold's orchestra, and his boss at the Weimar court wouldn't let him go.
Right, so he wanted to move to Curtin from Weimar.
Right, but he sort of, just to sort of break up the tension, goes to have a music competition in Dresden with Louis Marchand, and Bach did sort of a throwdown. You know, any instrument, any time, any stage, I'll be there. And Marchand said harpsichord, but he left and skipped town the day before the competition so that Bach won by default. And he came back with what he thought was, you know, sort of a, you know, German testament of musical superiority.
To this French guy. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And the Weimar court was so furious that he'd been doing all this, they promptly threw him in prison. And that's probably where he began work on Well-Tempered Clavier.
So Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, kind of an outgrowth of this competition that we're talking about, and which Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman recount in their new book called Top Dog. Bit of the Bach Well-Tempered Clavier, a work that he wrote probably while sitting in a prison in Weimar, Germany, where his angry boss had thrown him because he suspected, correctly as it turns out, that Bach wanted to take advantage of this competitive environment and move to a bigger and better job in Germany in the Baroque period. We're speaking with Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. Their brand new book is called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing. So Poe, let's take this scenario. You have two musicians of equal skill. They've both done their 10,000 hours. They're really good pianists. They're put into a kind of a stressful situation, let's say an audition to, you know, be a soloist with a top Philharmonic orchestra or something. Why, all other things being equal, why does one outperform the other?
Principally by really being up for that moment at the right kind of level. So for a musician, it might be a certain level of arousal, a certain level of preparedness that isn't over-arousal, because one of the things with instrumentation is you have to be careful. You're not plucking anything or touching anything too hard,
Right. So you mentioned in the book that sometimes the pianist shoulders. There's shoulders, a Japanese researcher that there's a lot of tension in the shoulders, and they're hitting the keys
just slightly, ever so slightly. But these are considered sort of mistakes. And so there's a right level of being there. And this preparedness is a function of basically a hormonal buildup over the 24 hours before the audition. And in that moment, throughout entire body are all these blood vessels, and they're lined with smooth muscle. And in a state what's called a challenge state, your heart's pumping a little bit more, because these musicians are always, their heart rate's going to go up in this kind of a situation, even if they might not want it to. But their veins are dilated. The smooth muscles are relaxed. Their lungs are dilated. They're able to breathe. This brings more oxygen and energy out throughout the body. And associated with this is a slightly different neurological state, where they're not attuned to the worries about making mistakes. Their brain is, you know, deeply involved with the music and focused on a great performance, not on not screwing up.
So playing not to lose,
right.
Something that we hear in sports all the time, is a losing proposition when compared to playing, going out to win.
In an audition situation, because if you're just going in thinking, I don't want to mess up what I'm doing here, that paradoxically, that focus leads you to make more mistakes.
Ashley, what about gender differences? I mean, you write in the book that actually there are some pretty distinct gender differences in the way men and women handle the kind of stress that we're talking about in a competitive atmosphere.
Well, the research seems to say that women are more focused on the odds of success rather than what you're going to get from a victory. And the more you're focused, I mean, anybody, right? Think about if you're standing in line for Powerball, and you're standing in line and you're thinking to yourself, the odds of winning this is 1 in 195 million, you're going to leave the line, right? But if you're standing in the line thinking, I'm going to win 195 million, this is what I'm going to do, you're there. So there seems to be, women are really good actually at calculating the likelihood that they are going to win or that they are going to lose, but because of that, they're more likely to then sort of drop out or maybe shift into that sort of playing not to lose mode. They're being too careful. And one of the things, especially like an audition circumstance that I think is interesting, is that women tend to believe that their competitors are better than them, whereas men tend to believe that they're better than their competitors. Mm. So if you're in a room and you see a bunch of pianists, the woman's more likely to say, oh, there's no point because they're all so fabulous. I don't think I'm up to the challenge.
So, but clearly we have a lot of incredible women pianists at the very, and, you know, violinists, and we're even now seeing, you know, conductors. So that seems to be more a function of society than of innate ability. You know,
it's not about who performs the best. It's really making those decisions about, am I going to perform? Am I going to enter this competition? Am I going to try and join this quartet? And though it's interesting, the research about teams might indicate that it might help women who would say, I don't feel comfortable doing a solo career, but might be more interested in a quartet because then they have that group.
Mm.
One of the mistakes women make in competition is when they get nervous, they try and find a friend. Someone in the room to talk to, wow, this looks like a really big deal. You know, what music did you bring? Thinking that's going to reunite them. But what it's doing actually inadvertently is reducing that sort of chemical expression of preparation that Poe was talking about a minute ago.
Soundcheck listeners, have you ever been part of a competition that's played a role in your own creativity? Have you ever competed in an arts-related competition? How did you do? Leave us a comment on our website at soundcheck.org. We're talking about competition and winning and losing. The book is Top Dog. It's brand new from Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, who had previously written the New York Times bestseller Nurture Shock, which, you know, I mean, when we talk about kids, how much competition is good for kids? I mean, it's like they're competing to get into the right nursery school, without which they won't get into the right kindergarten. It's, you know, it goes on and on. How much of that
is... Well, we as parents are very aware of these competitions. The kid may or may not be aware. And I think the question we all have is, we are really worried about competition being a negative force in kids' lives, and to a point that we're missing some of the positive force it can be in their lives. And I think we should remove ourselves from discussion of whether competition is just good or bad and talk about what is healthy competition for children and what is unhealthy. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of opportunities for healthy competition. And what's very important in those is that no ultimate judgment on a kid is being made. Yeah, if they're being accepted or not accepted to a school, we probably want to hide them from that. In the same way that taking a standardized test where it's all about the score isn't healthy for them. Healthy competition is where you're also mastering something, mastering music, mastering the sport. You're making friends while you're there. You know, there is a lot of practice to the time that you perform, high ratio of practice to performing.
Well, and then there's also, it sort of comes back to what we were talking about earlier, the question of when it comes time to perform after all that practicing. Some people are reliable in a soccer game. They're reliable penalty kick takers. You guys talk about, you know, that situation in the book because it's a very stressful kind of 1v1 situation. There are other players who you do not want to put in that situation. And similarly with musicians, you know, we have someone as well known as Adele, you know, recently saying, "I have terrible stage fright." And, you know, there's a long list of musicians who have to really deal with that kind of extra additional stress. So what is it that makes those differences between people?
Well, it's very common. A survey of professional actors found that 70% of them said that they were dealing with stage fright in their most recent performance. And it didn't matter how accomplished their resume was, they were still scared. One researcher found that he thinks 27% of professional musicians are using beta blockers.
And the beta blockers are to sort of suppress the...
The hormonal responses that are, you know, having your heart race.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we wrote about in the book is that there actually turn out to be genetic variations, what we've sort of called warriors and worriers. And there's a gene, the COMP gene, that regulates the enzymes that sort of help you process and recycle and generate dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of your brain that's involved in planning and thinking and orchestrated higher level thought. And any sort of motivating experience, rewards, triumphs, successes, stress, create this dopamine response. But for these worrier people with this worrier gene, and it's really common, 25% of the population have a worrier gene, 25% have a warrior, 50% probably have both. And in those stressful situations, the worrier is the one who's going to have too much and suddenly melt down. This is the person who is great in the practice room, but once they're on stage, they're shaking so hard they can't hit the keys. That's the worrier. The good news is that the research shows that the worriers, if they have an experience of that kind of stress over time, can get more used to it. It doesn't mean it goes away, and they may still be nervous in a different context.
Right. So can a worrier become a warrior, or is it you're a victim of your genes?
You don't change your gene, but you can learn to have a different response to stress, and actually as a worrier. You can even, in one scholar's work, he's finding that you can even be a worrier and a Navy SEAL handling some of the most intense stress we could imagine someone could handle. It does take a long period of stress inoculation. You need to get used to it. And, you know, to your point about Adele and other musicians, you know, Bob Hope used to always say that he got enormously stressed out before a show, incredible anxiety, but that always meant it was going to be good. And the stress before a show may be quite orthogonal to how people perform. Very often, that very same stress leads them to produce a great performance. And for this, for a recent New York Times Magazine article story, we wrote about this COMP gene. We interviewed lots and lots of parents and kids who were taking a lot of tests and performing in different environments, and they would talk endlessly about how freaked out and stressed out their kid would get. But very often that kid was actually acing those tests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being stressed out is something that we actually have more control over how we interpret it than we realize.
Some years ago on the show, we were talking with a psychologist who dealt with performers with stage fright, and what he said, one of his techniques was to have the performer practice after doing really strenuous physical exercise, because it got the heart rate up, the breathing became, it kind of mimicked the physical effects of being really stressed out, of having stage fright. And once you got used to performing while dealing with those physical effects, it kind of, so in a way you practiced being stressed. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I love to sing, but I was never a good auditioner. I'm probably a worrier gene, and I would just get very stressed out. And so my natural predilection, avoid auditions. I would do the choir that you could just sign up,
right,
or I would
right.
just not really, I didn't really care about that part. But what I'm realizing is I should have done extra auditions for parts I knew I was wrong for, to get the experience level of, oh, so I screwed up, I was nervous, but I can keep going.
Yeah. Now, speaking of tryouts and auditions and stuff, another interesting moment in the book, and again, the book is called Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, is the symphony orchestra, where, as you guys point out, it's like these are musicians who are at the top of their game. They've been taught in school that they are really good musicians, and now they're in an audition situation where they want to stand out from the crowd to prove how good they are so they can get a job not standing out from the crowd
right.
and just being like a faceless part of this massive organization. And so what's the takeaway from that, Poe?
Well, the interesting takeaway is what is the results? You have these musicians who are all trained to be stars and soloists, now who have to be in perfect harmony and not stand out. And the result is not taken out on stage, it's taken out off stage. And so what the scholars who study this have found is that the better the orchestra, the symphony on stage, the more discord and interpersonal relationship trouble and animosity there is off stage. And it's very interesting because we have this notion of teams and that all these having great relationships drives great performance. The science is the other way around. Having great performances tends to improve relationships. But more than that is that just being on a team, this idealized notion of it's all cozy and it's all comfy, is not really what great team performances are about.
Mm-hmm.
Off stage, there's actually a lot of arguing, a lot of pushing each other, and a lot of rivalry to get better and better.
So it might be grand opera on stage, but it's a soap opera backstage.
Good line.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we've been sort of focusing in on the musical aspects of competition, but the book, of course, looks at business and sports, and it is The Science of Winning and Losing, as the subtitle says. The book is called Top Dog. It is new, from the authors Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman, who've been with me today on Soundcheck, and this has been really fascinating. Thank you, guys.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
This is Soundcheck. That's the New York Philharmonic performing the first movement of Mahler's Fifth Symphony. I am not suggesting that they're a great orchestra riven by internecine rivalry. It's just a nice recording of the Mahler Fifth. When a song goes viral on YouTube, it could start climbing the singles chart in pop music. We'll hear why Billboard is changing the way it tabulates the influential Hot 100 singles chart next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week, as you may have heard on our program, we learned that Billboard magazine had decided to shake up their popular Hot 100 singles chart. Now, Billboard has been charting pop music for over 100 years. Now they've announced they're going to count YouTube views when making up the Hot 100. That means that viral videos can now top the charts. just as this one did. Bauer's Harlem Shake debuts at number one. Joining us to explain the change is Billboard's director of charts, Silvio Pietrolongo. Hi, Silvio.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good. So what is the change? Is it simply that you're including YouTube views now?
Yes. A year ago, we expanded. We had some streamers in the charts since 2007, some streaming services. A year ago, we greatly expanded it to include a lot of the subscription-based on-demand services like Spotify, Slacker, Move Music, Audio. Mm-hmm. And just this week, we introduced YouTube to the streamers we already had on board. So the video streams on YouTube, on Vivo on YouTube now count towards the Hot 100 and some of our other hybrid sales airplay streaming charts.
So was there a particular reason for making the change now?
No. Well, we wanted to do it a while ago, but sometimes these things do take a bit of negotiation with the streaming providers, and there are data issues. You try to make sure are 100% accurate.
Right.
And it just worked out that this was the timing of it. It's something we've wanted to do for quite some time.
So it's basically a reflection of how people are getting music these days.
Yes, and it's a continuation of, you mentioned Billboard's been charting music for many decades. It's just a continuation of us going to where the music is being consumed and
right.
reflecting that activity in our charts, going back to, when it was just airplay and then sales and sales of cassettes, vinyl, CDs, and downloads just a few years ago, ringtones. So it's just a continuation of us trying to make sure that we're on top of where music is being listened to.
Okay. Now, just a kind of a procedural question here, but if you're now using YouTube views to help put together the Hot 100 singles chart, is there a chance that some cat playing a keyboard could top the Hot 100 if enough people are viewing it?
Well, if they're all using the same song, possibly. I mean, these are things we're working towards, learning as we go along. I can't tell you that for the many weeks of us looking at the data and testing the data, this Bauer phenomenon is the only one we've seen with enough volume, to influence the chart in this way.
Right.
So, whether this is the beginning of a multitude of these kind of memes that are, that you see on YouTube, I don't know, but these are things we'll look at and work through and figure out the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. So what's the reaction been so far?
People are always funny with change, especially people who follow our charts. But it's been a mixture of it's about time, and it's some people saying, well, this is going to taint the charts because you might have some of these, viral videos influencing, as you say.
Right.
Well, it's no different than any other change we've made throughout the years. There's always concern and praise at the same time.
Right. So does this mean that just, what makes a hit is now a different thing?
I think that's always been a moving target, especially now in the digital age. The past 5 to 10 years, it's a lot of the songs. I mean, you look at Psy's Gangnam Style,
right.
And we didn't have YouTube plays contributing to the chart at the time, but YouTube plays resulted in a lot of download sales. And those download sales resulted in radio airplay. And the more radio airplay you get, the more you sell. We've seen that kind of influence already, even though we didn't have YouTube on the charts, but we've seen those things manifest themselves in the other measurements that we did have.
And now that you've added YouTube views to the Hot 100, we've seen Psy, the creator of Gangnam Style, rebound from number 48 to number 26 because you're adding his millions of additional YouTube views. Drake has soared from 63rd to number 10 on the charts. And Rihanna's Stay jumps from 57 to number 3 with almost 4 million views in the U.S. alone, helping push her up on the Hot 100. We've been speaking with Billboard's director of charts, Silvio Pietrolongo. Silvio, it seems like, it's a way of keeping in step with how people really are discovering music today. Thanks very much for explaining it for us.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate it.
This is Soundcheck.
All along there was a fever. A cold sweat, hot-headed believer.
Back in December, the musician and producer Beck Hansen joined us to talk about Songreader, an album consisting solely of sheet music. We had some New York artists play their interpretations of Beck's songs live in the studio, and Beck was listening in by phone from L.A. It's a great show. You can find it on soundcheck.org. Well, there's an update to the story. One of those musicians, the singer-songwriter Amy Regan, actually met Beck in person last Thursday when she and her band performed at a Songreader gallery in Los Angeles. Beck apparently really liked her performance on Soundcheck and invited her out there. Here's the performance that Beck heard. It's Amy Regan doing his song, Do We Do.
Do we ever want to take the low road? Do we ever just want to say we're through? Do we want to lock the door and throw away the key? Do we do? Do we want to just look on the dark side? Do we want to wallow in the mud? Do we want to feel the world's against us? Do we do? Do we think it's sometimes just a nuisance? And other times a travesty to all who've tried but only fallen to ruins with their broken backs up against the wall? Do we want to say it's just a fool's game?
That's the New York singer-songwriter Amy Regan performing Beck's song Do We Do, which began as sheet music in Beck's recent collection called Songreader. Again, you can hear our interview with Beck and performances from Amy Regan and Stephen Merritt of Magnetic Fields on our website, soundcheck.org. That's going to do it for today's show. Tomorrow night, a performance by the R&B singer and songwriter Cody Chesnutt. 10 years ago, he broke out with a stunning debut in a song that was covered by The Roots. He'll play songs from a new album called Landing on 100. Cody Chesnutt, tomorrow at 9. See you back here then. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.